Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to a rainy afternoon in Sydney. Perhaps we've brought some Russian weather with us.
No, it's 31 degrees in Moscow now.
Must be glorious. Must be glorious. Vladimir Putin's re-election for a fourth presidential term in May 2018 has enshrined his position as the dominant personality of the post-Soviet era. I think over the past two decades, he's become synonymous with power and policy in contemporary Russia. We not only speak of Putin's system or Putinism, but indeed of Putin's Russia, an association between leader and country as intimate as that between Stalin and the Soviet Union more than six decades ago. With me here to discuss the Putin factor and the politics of Russia is eminent Russian journalist Yevgenia Albats. Dr. Albats is a Russian investigative journalist, political scientist, author, and radio host. She is editor-in-chief and CEO of The New Times, a Moscow-based Russian-language independent political weekly. She also is the host of Absolute Albats, a talk show on Echo Moskvy, the only remaining liberal radio station in Russia. She was an Alfred Friendly Press Fellow assigned to the Chicago Tribune in 1990. A Nimin Fellow at Harvard University in 1993. She graduated from Moscow State University in 1980 and received her PhD in political science from Harvard University in 2004. So there's no one more qualified to speak about contemporary Russia over the last two decades, Vladimir's worldview and where next in this very mysterious country viewed from the outside. And I think perhaps we'll start with the idea that Sir Robert Cooper, a British diplomat, once said, there's no such thing as foreign policy. All policy is domestic. Putin's adventurism abroad is driven by domestic preoccupations. So let's start with perhaps the fall of the wall. You were the first Soviet journalist to investigate the Soviet political police, the KGB. That's exactly where Putin started his career. Tell us about Vladimir Putin's worldview, the articulation of his goals as embedded in his experience in the KGB in the fall of the Soviet Union.
Okay, thank you very much for your kind introduction. Thank you very much to all of you for coming. I am so grateful to Melbourne University that brought me all the way from Moscow to this country, the country of my childhood dream. Yes, you know, I keep repeating this. Well, I'm traveling from Melbourne to Canberra and now here in Sydney, that when I was a child, I read a book on about small Aboriginal guy. And it was, of course, you know, Soviet times, and there was no chance to arrive in Australia anytime in the future, since, you know, there was the Iron Curtain and we couldn't travel. But that became my dream. Since then, I've been reading each and every book on Australia, I watched each and every movie on Australia. You don't know how much documentaries I saw in your country. You probably yourself never seen that much. So anyway, and that was like each time when something was happening in my life or something unfortunate was happening in my life, I was telling myself, okay, now I have time to go to Australia. Okay, now it's time to go to Australia and just have, you know, the dream of my life fulfilled. So thank you very much for this wonderful country. Secondary, in each and every audience in Australia, I start with apology. I apologize to you for what was done with respect to MH17, where 38 Australian citizens or people who live here perished as a result of the missile attack by Russian-supported separatists. I never voted for this government. I never was a Putin supporter. I never voted for him in any elections whatsoever. And still, since I am a citizen of the Russian Federation, I feel responsible and I am sorry. Unfortunately, as a result of the policies that conducted by Putin and his KGB clique, I have to apologize in many countries in the world, especially in Ukraine. So each and every time. So now talking about, first of all, I cannot miss, you said that Putin was elected for the fourth time. He wasn't elected. The kind of what you call elections didn't happen in Russia. Because as we well aware, as we well know from the political science literature, elections is not just a time when you come to the ballot box and put your ballot. It is a process when there is competition, contestation, equal access to the media outlets, and a possibility to deliver your basket of goods to your constituency. Nothing like that happened in Russia since Putin first was elected in March of 2000. In the last elections, Putin's main contestant and the leader of the Russian opposition, Alexei Navalny, was not allowed to run. He ran an excellent campaign. He established the outpost of his campaign in 84 regions of the Russian Federation. And I should remind you that Russia is the biggest, in terms of territory, the biggest country in the world. It's the country of 11 time zones. It takes me to get to the Russian from Moscow to Far East. It's longer to fly than from Moscow to Hong Kong. That's what I did. Of course, you know, flying to Australia, it's a totally different experience. I left Moscow on Thursday evening and arrived in Melbourne on Sunday morning. So, but anyway, it's so. Alexei Navalny was just not allowed to run, even though European Court of Justice had a verdict that evaluated the sentence that Navalny got on a totally invented reasons as wrong, and it was canceled. Still, Putin's government didn't allow him to run. So Putin didn't have any contestant. However, on top of that, he got his 74-76%, even though, you know, the analysis showed that first that there were added approximately 6% to what he already got. And without any contestation, Alexei Navalny or any opposition leaders were not allowed to any TV. So it just to tell you something about Russian democracy. It's not a democratic country. It is an authoritarian country, sometimes pretty severe authoritarian regime. And of course, you know, the corruption of everything and everywhere is something that it doesn't allow to turn into full-fledged dictatorship. Now, the kind of the regime that existed in Russia, we in political science tend to characterize as bureaucratic military authoritarianism. That's the kind of regimes that are widely used to exist in Latin America. That's the government which are based, of course, it's autocracies, which are based on the coalition of two parts. One are bureaucrat technocrats. These are people who are running the everyday business of economy. And they're pretty efficient in Russia, given that Russia hasn't collapsed the way Soviet Union collapsed back in 1991. And in case of Latin Americans, the second part are army people, military. In our case, that's the graduates of the KGB, the Soviet Union's political police. So these are people who have the same background, usually the same education, either the KGB high school or so-called school 101. Now it's Andropov's Intelligence Academy. They have the same argot. They speak the same language. They have their specific code of ethics. They have their specific code of glory. They have, you know, they usually intermarry inside the corporation. So, you know, so these people now, graduates of the KGB, control now 75% of all offices in the administration of the president and in the apparatus of the federal government. I would remind you that Russia is a semi-presidential republic. It's inherited its constitution after the French Fifth Republic. So we have an extremely strong presidency. And unlike it is in France, we have a very weak legislature. Now it's non-existent. It's a rubber stamp parliament, and no one par really in this parliament. Apart from controlling all the executive, and of course, you know, as I said, you know, legislature doesn't exist really in a way it should. KGB graduates of the KGB control all 10 biggest state-owned corporations, which are corporations which control Russia's wealth: oil, gas, telecommunications, IT, you know, all resource industry, all energy sector, banking center, and etc. So that's, I would call it the corporate state, pretty much the way we used to think about corporate state in Italy under Mussolini. We just pretend not to use the word that frightens us all, fascio, which is what the corporate state is all about. Of course, we should distinguish that it's not, that there is a huge difference between fascia and Nazi. Right, and Nazism. These are totally two different regimes. So it is a corporate state with all the grievances of the corporate state. Of course, as any closed corporation, it doesn't, it's very strict with respect to outsiders, and it doesn't allow people who pay their taxes and pay their way to look into the decision-making process. So that's the type of the regime that exists in Russia. And of course, Putin's background as a KGB colonel, that's exactly the kind of mistake that was made by Yeltsin's entourage when they decided to promote this pretty modest and totally unknown a guy who never ran for the office before, but they chose him because they believed that they were able to control him. Unfortunately, ignorance is one of the distinctive features of the Russian elite. Therefore, many mistakes that are made in Russia, it's not because, you know, they're so evil, or no, they're just purely stupid and ignorant. And that a mistake that, you know, they themselves pay for those mistakes. Many of them in jail, you know, many of them now, you know, lost their assets, you know, many of them now live in London and cannot show up in Moscow. But unfortunately, you know, along with them, we are the ones to pay as well. I mean, citizens of the Russian Federation. Now, talking about Putin's worldview, obviously, the guy who grew up inside the closed caste of the KGB corporation, he inherited most of the views of that, you know, that were that he was taught inside this corporation. In fact, you know, he came from a very low background. He had a very difficult childhood, quite poor. You know, he wasn't probably starving per se, but his life was pretty hard. So for kids like that, KGB presented a real opportunity, and he was good and quick in grabbing this opportunity. So he grew up as a man inside this corporation where, you know, the dominant view is this statist approach in which citizens are just small kids who are not good mentally enough, mentally and otherwise enough to get involved in the business of the state and make decisions on their own and everything. Everything like, you know, self-governance is just, you know, bullshit that people somehow grabbed these ideas from the West. So it is also the view of Russia as a superpower, which is capable to put to dust the entire world. And of course, first and foremost, it is capable to turn into the graveyard the biggest enemy that Russia used to have and still has. That's the United States of America. And as much as all of us, we admire the current president of the United States, I would say, you know, I put it mildly. So still, you know, it's what was publicly said time and again on Russian propaganda TV that Americans shouldn't forget that with one push of a button, Russia can turn Washington, D.C. into dust. Having said that, I would say also that Putin is an opportunist. Not a strategist, but he's a very good tactician. He's a great manipulator. He's a smart guy. It goes without saying. And as an opportunist, he is great in grabbing an opportunity, whatever exists, and proceed with it. He doesn't have values. He has a lot of practical reasons for that or in other steps. He's not about values. And, you know, if there is any value, it is that West is going to pressure Russia no matter what. And so Russia should be strong and always fighting West. That's the only way to talk to the West. Otherwise, you guys are going to grab our natural resources in Siberia, where one person is living by one square kilometer, and extract our oil and gas and whatever other resources we have. Chinese are doing this without occupying Russia on a daily basis. So Russia just rented, leased another 150,000 hectares of land in the Russian Far East to Chinese at the price of something like $5 per hectare for 49 years. So anyway, so that's the notion. So so the biggest problem from what exists with this type of the regime is that it's unable to learn. We all know that democracy is about learning. Of course, you know, we also know that autocrats are quite capable to learn from each other. And we see this exchange between Putin and Xi on a regular basis. And definitely, you know, Russia is trying to grab some of the techniques that existed in terms of suppressing the public opinion from China. However, unfortunately, Putin's people are unable to forecast events a little bit, you know, over some period of time. Otherwise, they would have never went for annexation in Crimea and starting the war in Ukraine, obviously, because the expectation was that, okay, West is going to swallow this, just exactly the West swallowed the war with the former Soviet Republic, Georgia, when the war that happened in 2008. Then United States imposed sanctions on Russia and forgot about all these sanctions in a three-month period. That what gave a go-ahead sign to Putin and his guys. That's why they were absolutely aware that there will be some noise in the media about human rights and all this stuff after the annexation of Crimea, but pretty soon West was going to forget about this. Yes, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I'm sorry, you know, I'm a teacher, so, you know, I'm getting accustomed to give a lecture, sorry.
No.
You all passed.
It's all brilliant. Evgenia, in one respect at least, it seems Putin has been astute, and that is that he's shifted his foreign policy, the center of gravity, to look more at non-Western powers, to look at China, to look at India, to look at Turkey, perhaps in response to or in anticipation of a souring between Russia and the West, a new Cold War we're increasingly talking about. What is the appetite in Russia at the moment for engaging in a new Cold War? I mean, let's not forget, in 2014, Barack Obama was still calling Russia a regional power. The annexation of Crimea was initially billed as a kind of step taken out of weakness, not strength. Is Russia gearing up for a new Cold War? And it seems as if the tables have turned almost. The old antagonisms between China and Russia have been mended. The West is now in a state of disarray. Donald Trump and his Western allies don't see eye to eye on many issues. Is Putin anticipating a new Cold War, or is he stumbling into one?
Of course, you understand that I don't talk to Putin on a regular basis. Otherwise, we would never annex Crimea and won't go into the war with Ukraine. However, I should correct you. Russia's turn to the east, to China, happened exactly after the annexation of Crimea and sanctions against Putin's closest entourage and certain Russian industries, so especially banking industry.
It was a reaction and not...
Of course it was reaction.
Yeah.
Of course it was reaction, because you have to keep in mind that Chinese population is 10 times bigger than Russian, and Russia has a huge demographic problem with shrinking population. It is one of the key problems that existed in the current Russia. And Russia's GDP almost 10 times, Chinese GDP almost 10 times that of Russia, and gap is increasing. And Chinese economy grows by 7%, whereas Russian economy grows by 1.5%. So Putin is clever enough to understand that he can be no one but a smaller brother to Chinese. And that's exactly the problem that bothers a lot of Russian bureaucrats who run the Russian economy, they got accustomed to look after Chinese from sort of upside down approach when they had West along with them, and they were seen as, you know, sort of, you know, an emerging market, but the kind of emerging market that was about to join the West and to serve as a bridge between the West and the East. However, when he got at odds with the West, then he found out that China is not ready to treat Russia as an equal partner, and that's exactly what happens. Because Russia needs from China labor resources, money, and technologies. And what Russia is ready to give in exchange? Land. And that's exactly what we're doing. You know, the woodland along the border with China was there just last summer. Is totally under control of the Chinese companies who are cutting wood there. Natural resources, and Russian markets. So basically, you know, China's approach to Russia is, you know, to the third world country.
Is Putin ready to be the junior partner in this Sinocentric world order?
That's why, you know, no, he's not ready. And that's why Russian elite, and especially Putin himself, was so eager to help Donald Trump to become the president of the United States, or at least not to allow Hillary Clinton to become the president of the United States. And we see from the Mueller report, volume one, that immediately after Trump got elected on November the 4th, 2016. Russian envoys were sent from the Putin's close entourage were sent to the United States to establish a special relationship with the upcoming administration with only one agenda: to abandon sanctions. Western sanctions has created hell of a lot of problems to Russian businesses, Russian economy, but the most, but also from the standpoint of Putin's and his entourage, he lost the leverage against China. And of course, China is Russia has a border of China and long-standing history of all kind of semi-military conflicts and etc. So Putin was ready to make all kind of land concessions to China, and maybe rightly so. I don't know. We know that you know a lot of that some land which Russia and China fought for back in mid 1960s. Now Putin gave up to China in beginning 2008. So, but once again, you know, definitely Russia needs West very much. Mm-hmm. Russia needs West because it's suffering without Russian technologies, because Russia Russia is unable to explore oil on Arctic shelf without the technologies that Russia didn't have and it used to get from the United States and machinery that it used to get from Germany and many other, you know, all Russian banking system is based on software from the West. And now it is one of the biggest problems for the Russian banking system, what to do in the condition where they are unable to update their software. And how they're going to run. You know, there are talks about, you know, establishing Russian credit cards for quite a while, but they cannot do this because we don't have technologies for that. We don't have software for that, etc. So, no, it's not going that easy. And on top of that, despite of all these, you know, kisses and hugs, with President Xi, there are ongoing talks about China investing $50 billion, $60 billion, whatever, and then nothing happens. In fact, you know, when last year I was in Irkutsk, it's a city near the lake of Lake Baikal. It's just 1 hour flight to, from Beijing. It's much closer to fly to Irkutsk from Beijing than from Moscow, of course. So, and I spoke to Chinese businessmen there. I was curious because I saw that on the clothing market called Shanghai, there were all goods from China, but there were no Chinese. These were, they hired Kyrgyz people, people from former Soviet Republic in Central Asia, Kyrgyzstan, to do all the job. And so I asked the Chinese businessman, wait a second, why you don't create, you know, some plans here? So why don't you invest in some real stuff here? After, well, after all, you know, you're using this timber from this land. And he said, no. We realized that, you know, that Russia has a problem with understanding of the property rights. And therefore, you never know, you will set up a production in Irkutsk, and then in 5 minutes, guys from, you know, as we say it, from FSB will come and say, please, 50%. So anyway, and apparently, at least in this part of the Eastern Siberia, Chinese businessmen are not looking into bringing technologies to Russia. They are in the business of extracting, of course, resources, as they do in Africa, of course, you know, in many countries in Africa. Russia is trying to do this now only, you know, through trying to get involved in elections in Africa. In some 20 countries, Russians were involved in the latest elections. Anyway, so no, it's a huge problem. Mm-hmm. And I hope that Putin is smart enough to understand that, in order to have somewhat equal relation with China, he badly needs the West.
Mm. And of course, there's more than China in Asia, and Russia still has warm relationships which are born out of historical ties with Vietnam, with India, even with North Korea to an extent. And the pivot to Asia is more than just China, but it does seem more and more economically bound together, the two. It's interesting you mentioned the natural resources. It does seem to be the primary fixation for China. There's resource insecurity for China. It now needs to procure 600 million tons of oil equivalent every year just to sustain China's economy. And in order to diversify and get secure access to energy, I think Russia is the absolute linchpin required for that. But my next question to you, turning back to liberalism in Russia, you said last year, Western media unfortunately wrote us off too quickly. Russian liberals are alive and battling. Now, you describe a very difficult situation. You seem to have a rather pessimistic outlook as well about the politics of Russia. In 2015, we had the assassination of Boris Nemtsov. Last year, your paper, your newspaper, was hit by a fine, which was, I think, probably designed to cripple to get you out of publication entirely. It was a fine of over $500 million of Australian dollars.
No. 400,000. Australian dollars, not millions.
Sorry, that's what I meant. Yeah, half a million, half a million. I don't think you're making that much money in terms of your revenues. But it equated to something to your annual revenues, essentially. So it would have been a very difficult fine for you to pay, was it not for the fact that you went and crowdsourced, and that's perhaps the silver lining in all this, is that somehow you were able to pay the fine because of generous contributions by the public. So there are silver linings here, it does seem, and you do seem, to an extent at least, optimistic about your ability to continue to function in Vladimir Putin's Russia.
You know, I have no other choice but to be optimistic. Otherwise, I'm dead. So I grew up in the Soviet Union, and there was an Iron Curtain. My father worked in the military industrial complex. He was so secretive that he couldn't travel to the center of Moscow. We lived in the outskirts of Moscow, in the buildings which were built for those who were involved in all kind of missiles, you know, and all this military industrial complex stuff. And I never thought that I was going to travel abroad. So, in that respect, I was very lucky. I saw the end of the Soviet Union. I grew up in the situation when I had to read Orwell's 1984 in a matter of 24 hours on a tobacco paper, you know, this very thin paper. That's how Orwell was smuggled into the Soviet Union. And you could easily get 7 years of labor camp for distributing Orwell. I grew up in that, and now, you know, I've been to many, many countries in the world, and as you can see, there was no way for me to speak freely either inside or outside Russia during the Soviet times. So, and to be sure, I never say anything abroad what I don't say inside the country. That's my principle. I say exactly the same thing in my program, Absolute Alberts. Who knows how long it will continue to go, but I do this, and I make it's my principle. I never say anything abroad that I cannot say inside my country. I'm not loyal to my state as an institution, but I'm always consider myself obliged to be loyal to my country and to my fellow citizens. When we got this awful fine for absolutely nothing, truly nothing, you know, I'm not going to go into details, but trust me, there was just... It wasn't that we didn't pay something or we didn't pay something. No. We didn't submit virtually one piece of paper with one table to one of the Russian, of the watchdogs, which we submitted, of course, to all other state institutions. But there was the new legislature and the very first time, and that was, you know, after the annexation of Crimea, the whole new legislature was brought about that created enormous difficulties to the opposition media. And as a result, there was, you know, some article, and we were the very first and the only one so far to experience this new article in the Russian administrative court. Anyway, but the most important thing that's true that when they imposed this awful fine on us, 22 million rubles, 250,000, 250 million rubles, it was in US dollars, $370,000, the biggest fine ever in the history of the Russian media. We addressed to the people, and in the, we raised this money in a matter of 96 hours. 18,000 people from all across Russia sent us money. The mean check was 600 rubles. It's less than $9. 18,000 people put their first name, patronymic name, and their surname on paper, knowing that, of course, FSB has access to all this paperwork, and made it clear that they transferred money to a weekly which is considered to be anti-Putin's weekly. So it was a real courageous step for many people who otherwise were afraid to subscribe to the New Times because they were afraid that their concierge were going to see our covers. So it was absolutely, and that tells you that that Russians, you know, we have a very unfortunate history in terms of human rights. Of course, all of you know this a little bit, right? In each and every of our family, you know, somebody perished in Gulag. My grandfather was executed on November 1, 1937. I just got his file from the KGB. He never, there was just nothing, and he got killed at the age of 37. But I think there is some point, at some point when Russians feel like we should stop it. And that exactly, I think, what happened to us. Yes, Russia is a strict authoritarian state, and we have a long road to go, and we made ourselves, besides Putin and all these KGB thugs, we ourselves, we made a hell of a lot of mistakes. However, I have no doubt that Russia will become a democratic country because all research suggests that democracy is the only regime in which people don't suffer from mass starvation and mass repression. That's it. And people do want to be happy. And Russians are no different. They want to be happy as well.
Right. So we now have 15 minutes to entertain a number of questions from the audience. Okay. Who wants to start?
Doctor, my name is Jim Dominguez. I'm a political observer and Russia gets some focus. There was a book written, Red Notice, by Bill Browder. You're familiar with that. And we thought that matter was resolved, that Browder was very successful in getting the support of the US Congress. You remember, and it's a graphic read. But only 12 months ago, Interpol, on another red notice, locked him up and he was almost on a plane back to Russia. How would Putin would have that sort of influence over a much respected international entity as Interpol?
Right. Thank you very much for your question. First of all, he wasn't put on a plane back to Russia. He was released in a matter of 12 hours. Interpol agreed that there was a mistake made. Yes, Putin has this power, and Kremlin was trying to promote their guy to become the head of the Interpol, and they failed. So, yes, Russians, KGB guys are very shrewd and very capable. When you close your eyes and look the other way around, when you don't, then they fail. Now, yes, it's a great book, Red Notice. It was translated in Russia, but was published only in Ukraine, and my magazine was the one that published parts from this book. But don't worry, he's okay. So he's doing fine. I saw him in London, so everything's okay.
Hi, my name's Simone. I'm a public servant here in New South Wales and a student of Russia. We've been speaking a lot about Putin's Russia, but what about post-Putin Russia? Are there any candidates to be successor? Is society preparing for that eventuality?
I know. You want me to read a crystal ball. Sorry. I would be very rich if I could. Mm. Unfortunately, I'm not. Now, I've been talking here for quite a while about the corporation, and you keep asking me about Putin. It's no longer about Putin. And for those of you who do foreign policy stuff, I think it's important to understand that the problem is not just Putin. The problem is the corporation, which is controlling all the major Russian assets along with the power of the state. It is the corporation that, on top of having all the wealth of the, or almost all the wealth of the country, which controls now also, you know, 60% of the Russian economy back in the hands of the state, it also has the power of uncontrolled violence or monopoly on violence that only the state institution, the state as an institution has. And it also has all the power of the secret services. So this kind of regime, in fact, never existed in the last 100 years. It is the combination of the power of the state, as any state has the power for violence. You and I, we don't. And the whole Law Institute doesn't. But the state has the right to change the behavior of the people by using violence or the threat of violence. And that's what these people who control the wealth of this great country, which Russia is, have in their hands. And on top of that, they have the kind of tools and means that only secret services have. The power of surveillance, of eavesdropping, of getting information through all kind of means of conducting cyber wars, of eavesdropping or, you know, reading the reading stuff of your economic rivals, and etc., etc., etc. That's the problem that we face and you face. And you will be better off to understand it sooner rather than later. So it's not about what's going to happen 2024. For sure, Putin will stay this way or another, not because he wants or he doesn't want. It's not up to him. Because as much as he's the leader and the front of the corporation, he is also the hostage of the same corporation. And the minute he walks out of the Spasa gate or Boravitsky gate, he's dead. So it is a Hobbesian world that this corporation created of its own validity. It's a Hobbesian world. Everyone is at war with everyone. So, yes, that we can, you know, guess whether, you know, the current mayor of Moscow, Mr. Sobyanin, or whether, you know, Putin's pal from KGB outpost in Dresden, the Soviet times, Mr. Chemezov, the head of the Russia's biggest industrial corporation, which incorporated some 500 factories and plants, especially in the field of military industrial complex, will become his success. It doesn't matter.
Well, I think it does matter.
No. It doesn't.
in that, the next few years will be important. I mean, you allude to the fact that the corporation runs the state. It's not Putin. Putin may be the hostage even. Particularly because that is the case. What is the level of internal dispute, rivalry within the corporation? Is the corporation going to survive a post-Putin era, or will it turn on itself? Will we see a more violent form of Russian politics emerge within the corporation? Or will they somehow manage the succession smoothly in such a way that it comes out stronger?
Listen, do I look to you like a god?
Somewhat.
Do you feel like I'm over there?
But
over yeah. Looking? No. So, unfortunately, I'm not so stupid even to go into that discussion. Mm. I would say the following. Yes, of course, there is inter-executive cleavages, and there are all kind of other cleavages that existed in Russia. That, of course, as it happens in each and every authoritarian state, which incorporates all branches of government that existed in democracies into one, into one branch, into the inside the executive, there is clashes all the time. And, you know, Sechin, the head of the Rosneft, you know, the biggest oil company in the world, is constantly at odds and at the throat of Mr. Chemisov, and they're fighting with each other. And let them fight. When they are at each other's throat, we journalists get some information. So we love it. And I always like love when, you know, they kill each other. However, first of all, if somebody tells you that he knows who is going to be Putin's successor, give him $1 and let him go far away, because no, Putin himself doesn't know what he's going to do. There are different options existed. Yes, at some point, some people say that Putin was going, that Kremlin was trying to establish some sort of a treaty with the leader of Belarus, another former Soviet republic, which serves as a buffer state between Russia and the West, and to establish some sort of a new state which will allow for Putin, without violating the Russian constitution, but by creating the new constitution of the new state, to run for yet another term and become the president of another state. Doesn't it sound to you a little bit complicated? Is it feasible in 4 years to do? And why Lukashenko should be such an idiot to become a vassal of a Putin's, whereas now he is a full dictator in what was one labeled as the last dictatorship in Europe, where, you know, he has his son Nikolenko as his successor, and who sees Belarus is a very poor country. And so I don't think that it is feasible in any way. There are all kind of other plans. You read it all the time, especially in the Western media. And of course, you know, some people feel like they know. I'm not. I'm sorry. I don't.
All right. We have time for one or two more questions. Maybe Alex Oliver, Director of Research at Lowy Institute.
Thank you. Thanks, Doctor. I was just curious about the Russian interference in the US elections in 2016 and how spectacularly successful they seem to have been. Talking about the corporation, how much do you know that was an explicit or deliberate sort of operation of the corporation, or did it take itself by surprise, you know, through some sort of rogue operations from some element of the corporation rather than it being a whole of corporation policy?
Thank you. It wasn't the first time that Russians did it. When Reagan was about to run for his second term in office, and Yuri Andropov, the former head of the KGB, was the leader of the Communist Party, and of course Communist Party wasn't a party but the form of governance, anyway, he ordered three Russian residenturas in New York, in Washington, and in San Francisco, to get involved in the elections and to prevent Reagan from getting into the Oval for the second time. There was a campaign. There was this active measure operation conducted all around the United States and in some countries of Europe, especially in the Northern Europe, under the slogan, Reagan means war. The result was a landslide victory of that of Reagan's. He carried out 49 states out of 50, I believe. Maybe, yes, 49. I believe I'm correct. So it's not the first time. Soviets time and again were involved. And By the way, if you want to understand what Putin's pals are doing and what they're going to do with respect to the practical issues like elections, in the future, just look in the back. They're using the same instruments and the same tools. As you know, when people, I can tell you out of my own experience, when you're getting older, you look back and you see, what, how did I do it back then when, you know, guys were whispering my name in the bushes? Ah, okay, so I'm going to do the same. So now, with respect to the elections in the United States, we know for sure that Russians were involved. And if you read the volume one of Mueller's report, you get a lot of... I think that what was written in the Steele's report, the famous Steele report, I think it was a little bit of exaggeration based on true and false information. I think that all the way till July of 2016, just right prior to the Republican convention in Cleveland, I was there, by the way, Kremlin wasn't really taking sides. The whole idea was to bring chaos to the American elections. In fact, that's the basic idea. The same we see all around Europe. Yes, of course, Putin is going to be happy if European Union falls apart. And of course, you know, Great Britain gives him just one happy hour after another. Somebody said, why Brits don't drag Cameron along the streets of London? But anyway, so... that was the basic idea. And yes, he did hate Clinton. Because at the times when number two, Medvedev, was a president, you know, he had to deal with Clinton on a regular basis, and their relationship were no good. But the yes, there were all kind of active measure operations conducted. Yes, the access to the data from Facebook allows to reach 106 million people in the United States with the specific messages. Yes, there is a study done by a professor from UPenn, University of Pennsylvania. She's a specialist on presidential elections, and she's a statistician. And it suggests that, and you of course know that Trump won the elections with 10,000 votes in Michigan, 30,000 votes, less than 30,000 in Wisconsin, and 70,000 votes in the state of Pennsylvania. That's how he got electoral colleges there. The message that was carried by Russia's proxies through the Facebook and Twitter might have impact on the voting behavior in these three crucial states. Her research suggests that people who were to come out and vote for Hillary, they just didn't vote all at all. And we know from stats that, yes, the kind of black turnout that we had during the Obama elections, Hillary didn't get. So there was definitely an impact. What we don't know is to which extent Russian involvement had impact on the final outcome. But of course, when it comes to 10,000 votes, you just think about this. Michigan was the state that voted blue, voted Democrats, since 1988. And all of a sudden, in 2016, Michigan voted Republican. It is, obviously, it may be a deviation, God knows what, but it was just 10,000 votes that turned the tide, that basically, because, you know, then Wisconsin, of course, followed, and Pennsylvania was pretty much expected. But you also can say that Hillary Clinton was just once to these crucial states, Michigan and Wisconsin, and when everybody advised her, Bill Clinton himself told her, go to Michigan and Wisconsin in November, just exactly what Trump did. Trump went to those states in early November. Instead, Hillary went to Pennsylvania and basically preached to those already converted. So, but definitely, trust me, you will never stop me if I don't want to stop. So,
I'm afraid we're basically out of time.
Yes, it's okay. So, there was definitely a Russian intervention in the American elections. Absolutely. Yeah. We know for a fact on both sides of the ocean and from the investigation that was done in Russia by Russian journalists that the Russians did interfere in the U.S. presidential elections. However, it wasn't the first time, and it's not going to be the last time when Russians interfere in elections in the Western democracies. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you very much. Evgenia Albats, you've really enlightened us. I think it's been a fascinating journey into domestic politics in Russia, its continued role in the world. Interesting as well that Trump would have had to have been a viable candidate to begin with for the Russian attempts at making him win. It might have been the straw that broke the camel's back. It hasn't been as successful in France, I've noticed. So perhaps, you know, our resilience is increasing. But thank you very much for your time today. We've learned a lot. We hope you will be back in Australia. We're really grateful that...
I will be on the plane the next day.
Yeah, that this is the land of your childhood dreams. That's something we'll remember. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.